Obama's busy day.
Getting to know you, getting to know all about you.
The best part is you can wake up and look at yourself in the mirror.
News conference with the British Prime Minister, invitations to Russia and China, meetings with the Queen, Obama and all those other leaders. What will we call them? The G19? Base camp meets the summit. Obama on top. For now, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It is Thursday, April the 2nd. I'm Femi Okeh. Adora Udoji is away spending time with her new baby. So coming up this hour, we'll discuss the G20 and all the talk about a new international currency. We'll also discuss the Internal Revenue Code and how many people actually do their taxes correctly. And we'll also hear about a Vermont bill that would legalize gay marriage in the state. Those stories coming up, but first, headlines.
Business before breakfast. That's President Obama's agenda at the G20 summit in London. First up today was a meeting with South Korean President Lee Myung-bak. The economy wasn't only fodder for conversation.
We also have a great range of issues to discuss on defense, on peace and stability in the Korean Peninsula.
You can hear those presidential sniffles. The leaders both agreed for the need to have a united response to North Korea's planned rocket launch. G20 protesters are awake, too. Hundreds of police officers have been deployed to control any further demonstrations. More than 80 have been arrested so far. Some protesters smashed windows in the financial district. However, most protests have been peaceful. Femi?
The Obama administration is seeking funds to train and equip Pakistan's military. That's according to defense officials. The announcement comes after General David Petraeus told Congress yesterday that militants near the Afghan border are a grave threat.
The extremists that have established sanctuaries in the rugged border areas not only contribute to the deterioration of security in eastern and southern Afghanistan, they also pose an ever more serious threat to Pakistan's very existence.
Petraeus continues his testimony today along with the top Pentagon official, Marshall Flournoy. The House votes today on legislation that would allow the FDA to regulate tobacco products. The bill won't let the agency ban tobacco outright, but it would let the FDA prohibit flavoring and require larger warning labels. Now, if it passes in the House today, it still faces a Senate vote.
Some good news for some of our colleagues. Two of our partners have won Peabody Awards. That's the broadcast equivalent of a Pulitzer Prize. PRI's This American Life won for a show called The Giant Pool of Money about the financial crisis. The New York Times also received a Peabody for its extensive website. Asian stock markets shot up today. Benchmark indices in both Japan and Hong Kong up more than 4%. Wall Street looks like it's going to bounce off the bottom. The Dow kicks off today at 77.62. The S&P starts at 8.11. So Obama has invented something.
Right.
iPod diplomacy.
Okay.
Hey, I hand a world leader an iPod with a specially customized playlist on it.
Yes, like he did with the Queen yesterday.
It's going to change the world, okay? Mm-hmm. He did it with the Queen yesterday. So we want to invite you to choose a world leader and to start a playlist for that world leader in the interest of world peace, okay? Brian Eno for, say, Hamid Karzai, some quiet chamber music for Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe. What songs would you put on a diplomatic playlist at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. This is The Takeaway. I'm here with Femi Okeh and
Adora
Udoji. Good morning, Femi. You know, anyone can do it, this diplomacy, this iPod diplomacy thing, a presidential iPod with
yes.
a custom-made playlist for world leaders.
I like it.
I mean, let's see. Brazilians need to listen to more Led Zeppelin, I think.
How about Iranians George Michael?
Okay, Iranians George Michael. How about Hugo Chavez needs more choral music? Fewer solo vocals, I think, for Hugo Chavez.
Jonas Brothers, I can
possibly
hear them.
Australians need Motown. Definitely Australians need Motown. Put playlists on presidential iPods in the interest of world peace at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. So the G20 summit is underway in London. World leaders are hoping the day will end with some kind of a global deal, or at least an indication of the way ahead for tackling the worldwide recession. It is a moment that can remind us all of the year 1930, a moment when the world was then 18 months into the Great Depression. There was a new leader in the United States. Stocks were down about 30%. Corporate profits had been cut in half. Unemployment had climbed from 4% to about 10%. Very reminiscent of today. Joining us is Liaquat Ahmed, author of Lords of Finance, The Bankers Who Broke the World. It is an extraordinary book, which I very much recommend. It's a profile of the individuals who actually were the central bankers back in the 1930s, who for various reasons broke the world, quite literally. Liaquat Ahmed, thanks so much for being with us from London.
Thank you.
Now, this is a fascinating story that you tell in your book, but I want to talk about the contemporary scene for a moment. As world leaders gather to talk about this latest economic crisis, there's a cautionary tale in your book about the misleading lessons of history. What would you be most concerned about the G20 leaders getting wrong today?
Well, I mean, it's most reminiscent of the 1933 London Economic Conference. That occurred in London. This one's occurring in London. And the danger is that they try to agree so hard that they do the wrong things. So far better that they disagree but do the right things than sort of stitch together a deal and try to coordinate but do the wrong things.
Now, some of the things on the table involve getting out from under the dollar as the global reserve currency, or as the Russians have suggested, going back to the gold standard, which was so disastrous back in the 1930s. First of all, what would be the argument for returning to the gold standard at this day and age?
Zero. The argument about moving away from the dollar is that by making the dollar the reserve currency of the world, in effect, we give the U.S. a free pass and allow it to indulge in all sorts of economic policies that are dysfunctional. So it's not disciplined in the same way that other countries are. The argument in favor of gold is almost zero, because there's simply not enough gold to act as the primary reserve currency in the world. I mean, the world economy is just simply too large.
Why did the central bankers back in the 30s not understand that the world had outgrown the gold standard in pure scale? And what is it they might be missing about the dollar right now?
Well, in the 1930s, they were looking nostalgically back to the world before the First World War. I mean, we forget that 1929 occurred only 10 years after the First World War ended, and their whole goal during the 20s was to turn the clock back and recapture this sort of this golden age which existed before the First World War. Unfortunately, it was like trying to put a genie back into the bottle. There'd been so much debt issued during the First World War that trying to go back onto the gold standard basically put the world into a straitjacket.
Now, I see, though, a lot of talk among the world leaders at the G20 about turning back the clock to address this crisis in the way that might have been done in the 1930s. I mean, you tell in your book, The Story of Lords of Finance, of how, and you describe it right there, of how leaders fixed the wrong crisis. They fixed an earlier crisis and didn't really address what was going on in the 1930s. Is there a danger that the G20 leaders will try to fix the Great Depression of the 30s and miss the Great Depression of the 21st century?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that this time we do have people in charge who understand pretty much what's going on. I think the big divide at the moment is between the Americans, who basically believe that we need the government to spend money in order to lift the world out of a depression or recession, and the Europeans, who believe that if we have more government spending, they will have to issue debt, and that will undermine confidence. And so that's the big difference.
And does that difference help solving this crisis? You said that disagreeing but doing the right things anyway would be just fine here. I'm just wondering if the disagreement actually gets in the way of the sort of scale of the stimulus that's needed here, if you buy that argument, or the scale of restraint that's needed, if you buy that argument.
Yeah, look, it would clearly be better if they agreed to do the right things. But in the absence, I think it would be a mistake. I mean, my personal view is that the Europeans are on the wrong track, and that the world desperately does need a stimulus, a global stimulus package. But far better for the Americans to stick to their guns and go ahead with their stimulus package than to try to have that curtailed by the Europeans.
Now, your book is about four individuals who are responsible for the central banks of Britain, France, the United States, and Germany, people who, as you describe so eloquently, are lost to history today. Are there equivalent characters in the G20 who are controlling levers out of sight of the public who may be similarly looked at by the lens of history?
Well, I'm not sure similarly looked at, because I'm hoping that they'll do the right thing
right.
this time. But essentially, I mean, the reason I focus on four individuals was to really illustrate the point that we invest enormous authority in our high financial officials. Heads of central banks are given just a gigantic amount of control over the world economy, and it's very hard to hold them fully accountable. So I think there's a paradox there. So, yes, there's no question that key central bankers and key finance ministers and secretaries of the Treasury have enormous power to get it right and also get it wrong.
Do you think the personality of Timothy Geithner is appropriate here, and the stumbles that he's made out in public? Would it be better if he was more behind the scenes? And what do you make of the central bankers in Japan and China?
Well, I think their personalities are less of an issue this time than they were then. I mean, those guys were somewhat eccentric. I think the fellows running the show now are much more professional. In Timothy Geithner's case, I think he certainly stumbled initially, but I think he's trying to recover. In his dilemma is not so much a sort of personality issue as a political issue, that really to accomplish what he has to accomplish, we have to inject a whole lot of public money into the banking system. And there is no way that Congress will approve that at the moment, or the American people will approve of that.
Leah Kent, hello there. It's Femi Okeh here. I'm
Hi.
Just looking at the timing of your book and the title of your book, and it's just so timely. As your experience in investment banking, were you just watching to see when the markets were going to drop for when you just had to publish your book? It just was spooky.
I started working on this 4 years ago, and I did think that we were going to have a crisis. Not in my wildest imagination did I believe that the whole Western financial system was going to come down like a house of cards.
Although, you know, maybe you should just get out of the writing game and go into advising people on their retirement accounts with that kind of view forward.
Well, better to be lucky than smart.
Better to be lucky than smart. Well said. So the change that took place in the Great Depression was that the economy and the financial system was truly fully globalized. What do you think the fundamental change will be in this depression, as far as you can see? It seems to me that on the surface, it's the democratization, the sort of world governance issues are suddenly being injected into global finance. It's not taking place behind closed doors anymore. What do you see?
I think that's partly true, but I think the main change is that we allowed the financial system to become something of a Frankenstein and get out of control. And I think the main change is we will go back, we will try to get this Frankenstein under control, and we will end up with a financial system that's more boring, more stable, that doesn't attract all of the best and the brightest who come out of college, and, doesn't provide such large bonuses.
Well, a return to boring stability, something we all, a consummation devoutly to be wished. From Liaquat Ahmed, author of Lords of Finance, The Bankers Who Broke the World, a commentary on the G20. Thanks so much speaking to us from London.
Thank you, John.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.